Namaste. It's a joy to speak about the book, recent book by Dr. Rajiv Malhotra, The Battleground of Consciousness. Of course, he needs no introduction. His work speaks for itself. But just a few words which I have noticed. So, of course, Dr. Rajiv Malhotra is an intellectual Kshatriya, he says, but I would say he is more. He is, belongs to that category which now it has been maligned, but one of the work which at one place Sri Aurobindo says has the most noblest, the word has a noblest history, and that work is Aryan. So he is in the true sense an Arya, not Arya as has been understood, as you know, we have been made to understand that they were invaders, they were a racial type, no. But an Aryan who fights within and who fights without. So I know this from my little understanding and meetings with him, that he also has his own yoga practice, which makes him a person apart from just those who have played out ideas in the mind and they write books or they give talks. So he is attempted to be a Swarat. And one can see that in when it comes to ideas, that there is a great degree of mastery over the mind, the ideas, how they formulate and how they are formed. And then, of course, the Samrat. They are ideas which need to be reckoned by the world. So he is not just an Indologist in the normal sense of the word. In the sense, he is not just an Indologist because his roots are from India. And therefore, there is not a sentimental idealism attached to it. That's a different point altogether. I'm not saying that's right or wrong, but that's not the standpoint that he takes, as I have understood. Nor is he just a nationalist or racist or any of these terms which people may like to apply, that oh, why is he speaking so much about India and Sanatana Dharma, as if there is no good in any other culture. Well, as I understand, he speaks because he's an expert in that area. And that's something very beautiful. And second, something which I gladly, very much appreciate, deeply appreciate, is that he is bringing out certain key ideas of Sanatana Dharma and presenting to the world, not just because they belong to his own inheritance in terms of his childhood and upbringing, but because these ideas still can save the world. So I believe that certain ideas of Sanatana Dharma, not just the zero which has been so much publicized, but many other ideas need to be brought before the Western audience, the global audience, not just because, India is great and to prove to the world India is great. That's a different thought altogether. But because these ideas have the potential to save the world. They are a paradigm changer. So I'm so happy that he has brought out many books on this subject, and quite naturally, because these ideas have to save, can save the world. So we see in the world right now forces that are threatening these ideas. So his books on Bricking India, Snakes in the Ganges, of course everybody knows about them, and it's so true that there is in this world always these two forces which are struggling to achieve supremacy. So one is those that can lead the world towards a better integration, and others that will lead the world toward disintegration. And Dr. Rajiv Malhotra, without a doubt, stands for those forces which stand for integration and true unity in the true sense, which the ideas of Sanatana Dharma can create. So this is the basic background, which how I look at it. And so it gives me deep joy to speak about his book, The Battleground for Consciousness. So this is actually, if you look at it, consciousness is the ultimate ground which both science and human psychology, as well as human beings in their own subjective exploration, have to touch. There's a poem of Sri Aurobindo where he speaks about science. It starts with particles, material forms, then enters into energy, and then it enters into consciousness. So consciousness is the last ground. He uses the word battleground, not because consciousness is a battleground, but in a sense we can say that there are different consciousnesses at different levels, and there's a conflict in that, but because based on the idea that we accept of what is the fundamental reality, what consciousness is, and based on that, what humanity is, what are our goals. Based on that, we'll take one line of advance or another. So, what really is this battle about? Well, if we look at it, there are two ways of looking at it. One, which is the typical materialistic scientific point of view, where we are part of the phenomena and try to understand the whole. Now, obviously, this is at the face of it. It betrays common sense. It betrays even reason. If I am trapped inside a house, you know, as Plato said, and an example which is often given, if I am caught inside the house, so I try to deduce what the air that is entering through the window is all about, or what that light entering through the window is all about. Well, at one level, the air is continuous and the light is continuous, yet I cannot really understand the world outside unless I take care to not only open the door but to enter into that larger universe. So Indian psychology, Indian science took this approach that instead of digging just deep into the form, of course they dug it but in a different way, they entered into the subjective spaces, which is unique about man. And exploring these subjective spaces, they entered one layer after another, as we see in some of the Upanishads beautifully. Ultimately, they hit the stable ground, the ultimate reality. And this reality, though, is at its bottom subjective. But then it is that subject and the subjective reality from which this entire objective universe has come. And this universe is real. This is not to say that the objective is unreal. It's real simply because it is the emergence of this great truth within us. That's how the Vedic rishis gave us their own science of consciousness. They didn't speak in this word. But for example, if we read the Kena Upanishad, it's a wonderful science of consciousness. And Shurvindo, who's the subject which he takes up, Dr. Rajiv Malhotra, about his ideas of consciousness, and very rightly that he presents and makes it very clear that they are born from a different ground. So what it means they are born from a different ground when he compares it with Ken Wilber's and others is like if I go to, say, Himalayas and I stay with the in Mansarovar with the Siddhas and Yogis and swans which are supposed to be there, and I observe them and I live with them and I come back and describe them. This is going to be very different from somebody who has read a book on swans and Mansarovar and gives a talk. So this is where we must understand, because there is a tendency. There are people who talk about Carl Jung versus Shurbindo, Ken Wilber and Shurbindo. They don't realize that there is a fundamental difference between a yogi, a mystic, at whatever level he may be, and a person who is philosophizing on the armchair. Now, people may say that he has his own practice, but it's a different matter, you know. There are all kinds of practice, but all practices are not necessarily yogic practices. All meditation does not mean that a person is practicing yoga, because yoga is this question of breaking through the barrier or frame of ignorance in which we are currently caged. So before somebody can speak about yoga, yogi, mysticism and consciousness, which is fundamentally the gift of the yogi, he must have broken through the barriers of ignorance, discovered his soul, discovered the divine. That's how I look at it. Otherwise, one doesn't have the adhikar even to speak. And that's how in ancient times the science of consciousness and was developed and given to all of us. So, but now, of course, because things are available, they are in print, so everybody speaks, not only speaks. But what is more dangerous is that ideas are usurped. Leave aside acknowledging or not acknowledging is a different matter. But because one doesn't have the direct experience, so because one is motivated by all kinds of things, including, you know, name, fame, and putting yourself on the top shelf and bestsellers, that reminds me that, well, Shurbindo's The Life Divine perhaps never is a bestseller. That doesn't mean anything. But nevertheless, just because one wants to, because these are ideas which are very powerful, and they twist it, they distort it, and it is presented in a truncated way. This I know of, because even when people discuss about Jungian psychology and Shurbindo, I find it so amazing that how can one, I am speaking as a psychologist and psychiatrist right now, how can anyone who has read both of them can really compare and say that they stand on even closely similar grounds? When I compare the two, I feel if Shurbindo is like the Himalaya, complete Himalaya, not a Himalayan peak, then Jungian would be one of those foothills. How do you compare? I mean, to compare. And there is so much more that, you know. So when I use the word truncated, which is something which I often find in many of the conferences, that people, for example, will not speak about divine. Why? Because divine is not yet science. But, well, if we go back, all science owes itself to the divine. And that's how our science had developed within the Indian context. So I'm so happy that these thoughts are now coming into the mainstream. Thanks to men like stalwarts like Dr. Rajiv Malhotra, that we are beginning to discuss these things. And what really is this, these two approaches? Now, with regard to consciousness, we have a very interesting document of Sri Aurobindo. It's running in some 75 pages plus. And though he has written so many places about consciousness, if somebody was to just gather the material that Sri Aurobindo has written on consciousness, it would make a few volumes. You take out from the Life Divine, take out from the Synthesis of Yoga, take out from the Ishavasya Upanishad, take out from, you know, different places, and you'll have a volume. But here, Sri Aurobindo, this 75-page document is part of his essay, series of essays, short essays, which are, he has himself given the title as The Science of Consciousness. And he speaks about the science of consciousness as a science of the future. And he starts with a bang, that body, mind, they are instruments to be used by consciousness. So that in this paradigm, according to the Sanatana Dharma, the Indic paradigm, if you want to put it, consciousness is primary, it's a fundamental reality. And it's not an epiphenomena, as we see being debated today in the Western context, that, well, it's an epiphenomena because of brain activity or nervous activity. And I'm not going to go into details. I've given talks on this, these aspects. And besides, this is not the time and place to discuss that. But essentially, the fundamental difference is that a yogi identifies with this fundamental consciousness. How does he do it? By stepping back from form and name, or using the form and name. Even meditating upon it, but not with a view to be entangled in what is giving rise to the form, but going deeper into it, just as a yogin uses an image, a picture in the mind or an idol, and meditating upon it, he discovered the truth of the idol. Now, this is a process well known in yoga. It's called as identification. So by identification, he discovered the secret truth of everything. So Sri Aurobindo speaks of consciousness or the science of consciousness as a yogi would by discovering it. But he has the added advantage of not just being an yogi of yogis, if I may say so, but also because he is both at once also erudite, and he is extremely well equipped in terms of language, in terms of his study of history, in terms of his understanding of even modern science. So when he speaks, he understands what he is saying, and, you know, the world listens. Because, you know, for example, one of the places he says in the Life Divine, I remember, that the seed does not, you know, normally if you ask what explains the tree, so seed explains the tree. But he says finally that, and what explains the seed? The tree explains the seed, in the sense, so chicken egg dilemma. So he says that, well, both seed and the tree explain each other by something else, and that reference point is consciousness. So when you understand consciousness, which determines names and forms, it's a very fascinating field, and it's essentially a top-down view of creation. Again, the Gita would not use the word consciousness, but the entire Urdhva Moolam, you know, Ashwath trees, basically science of consciousness, but looking at creation from above downwards. On the other hand, there is this other view of creation, which we see today in materialistic science, largely in the Western context, but hopefully, and I think thankfully, the West is beginning to change. It is seeing things from below upwards. So when we look at consciousness, we look at it as an offshoot of phenomena. It's almost like asking a computer to describe the man. He's ill-equipped to do it. Probably somebody should pose a question to AI. What's your understanding of man? Or maybe still at another level, what's your understanding of woman? That's greater mystery. Even man would say, I don't know. So, and perhaps, of course, when you talk about God, he'll probably pick up some things about religion and do a mishmash of it. But that apart, it has a great potential to do damage, because they are young, impressionable minds who are carried away by all this. So he is doing such a wonderful work that on one side we have all these paradigms floating, and if we follow this paradigm, that the Western paradigm, that you know, consciousness is an epiphenomena, it has momentous consequences, which I don't need to discuss now, but if all is matter and nothing else but matter, on what basis or ground you tell your child that, look here, you should grow into a very ideal, beautiful human being. You should strive for the highest, you know, work towards perfection and progress. All this collapses. Frankly, if all is matter and an offshoot of matter, then even the validity of the word of the scientist has no meaning, because it's nothing but the babble of brilliant babble of billions of neurons, whose authenticity and veracity is itself in doubt. So not going into all that, Dr. Rajiv Malhotra has taken another even interesting part. So this is where the two paradigms stand. But there are those who appropriate the Indic thought and present it, digest it, half chewed, half digested and vomited out. Now this is dangerous, because the worst weapon of falsehood is to imitate truth. So there are a lot of people who get attracted. As I said, Jung, I put in that category. I know I may offend some people, but it's okay. And he has taken in, as far as I know, he wanted to come but never came, because he was always afraid that if he came and actually explored Indian thought by entering into it, he may get caught. So it's the way you look at it. You look at it that, you know, if you practice spirituality, you may be caught by spirituality and you may develop a biased view. Now, this is one way of looking at it. But how do you ever understand anything if you don't enter into it? If you want to enter, that's why even people have not practiced Tantra, they start saying, oh, ghoris, oh, they are dangerous people, they are eating, they are cannibals, all that. But when you actually explore these territories, which have not, it's a science, by like any other science, then you understand what it means in all its profundities, deities, depths, its power, its capacities, all these things. So he takes upon Ken Wilber and a few others of this kind, who basically appropriate the Indic ideas and they present it maybe in a very presentable way, because that's something I always say. There are two kinds of products, one which are given just like that and others which are packaged very well. And you see the power of packaging. Power of packaging is that people no more prefer the chapati made of mama's hands. They prefer the Maggie noodles. The way it has caught the mind and imagination of people. And sometimes even packed rotis, because mothers are not clothing it very nice, neatly wrapped packages and writing a name and giving it to the child. And yet, there is no way, common sense will tell us that the value of the mother's roti is far greater. So that's how I see these packaged products, and I often feel very amused when I see them. In my own in little way, I speak about them from time to time, and the young impressionable minds are caught up. That's the unfortunate part. Because they feel that, oh, this is so good. And now they read the contents and all this. So in packaging, there is no comparison of the way the Western propaganda system has packaged things. We have also caught that disease, though not quite yet, but it's on the way. But here, when you have to compare products, strip off the package. Look at it as it is. That's what we see Dr. Rajiv Malhotra doing. He's removing all that useless coverings, attractive products, looking at it as it is packaged. As far as I am concerned, I would say that a person who has not experienced consciousness, who has not been really a yogi, who is just a thinker, has no right to be put in the same bracket as a yogi. Now, people can put it, when I say no right, I am not saying you don't have a legal right. Of course, people can put themselves with anyone and everywhere they do it. I keep reading such strange, interesting, amusing books like Situating Sri Aurobindo, where you see Sri Aurobindo and many other, you give a chapter. Sri Aurobindo is Sri Aurobindo. If you have to make a comparative study, you do it with Sri Ramakrishna, with Swami Vivekananda, maybe some other mystics. That's okay, because you are Shankaracharya for that matter, Madhavacharya, Ramanujacharya, or some Western mystics like St. Augustine, some other who have been even good psychologists. That makes sense. It's okay. You may have your own views, but at least you are putting things which are together. But this tendency to pick up a mystic and a yogi and to put it in intellectual terms at the level of a thinker is actually to do grave injustice, not just to the mystic or the yogi, which is okay, yogi may not mind. People say, well, yogis don't mind, yes. But our concern is the younger generation. Because it's not about whether a yogi minds it or not. He doesn't mind it. But this is going into the world of ideas. And as I keep saying that there are young impressionable minds, they catch up the wave, like the woke culture. They don't even realize. They don't even know where it is coming from. And they just, it's like a wave and they pick it up. And they think it's a cool thing. So it's important that there are people in the world who whose work is to fight out this battleground and to bring out the truth which is inside, to show what the product really is, and engage with a younger audience with the language they understand, which is logic and reason. So, as I said, he is not a sentimental idealist who is saying, you must believe me simply because, you know, I am an Indian and it's an Indian work and everything Indian is great. He's not saying that. He is bringing out with solid research, evidence, and with proper study of whatever he is doing. And that's something very beautiful because it appeals to a certain kind of mindset, especially among the young. So I wish him well. This book, of course, as I have seen his books, is certainly, according to me, a must read for all those who want to delve a little deeper into a comparative study of consciousness, especially who want to see how Sri Aurobindo's views have been taken up and presented, and who may, and I know number of people who do that, personally I know, who not only may, who pick up those half-chewed ideas and take it to be true and don't care to study Sri Aurobindo in the original. And so if one wants to really do a course correction, of course, reading this book and books of this kind are very useful. But the ultimate course correction is read Sri Aurobindo and go one step further, engage with the practice, experience what consciousness is. Because then you are open the door, you are out. When you are in that state where Sri Aurobindo says in one of his poems, I have wrapped the world in my wider self. London and Tokyo and Paris, my spirit seeing are. When you begin to experience, as he says in another place in Savitri, Arcturus and Belphegor burn in a corner of my boundless self. When you actually experience that Vishwarup, that boundless self, and then it is no more that it's an individual who is himself a phenomena, trying to study universe and cosmos, and sometimes I feel like just giving a little funny rebuke, if I may say so. Somebody who is talking about evidence of God and, you know, intellectual terms. So one day somebody was arguing like that with some other group. So I butted in as, what is the evidence that you exist? Prove that you exist. Now you see, you'll be hard put to prove. You'll end up by saying, I know that I exist. Not going into the semantics. But this is how it is. So, you can talk about these things when you have some experience of it. Sri Aurobindo has the full experience of the universal consciousness. So when he speaks about universal consciousness, when he speaks about global consciousness, when he speaks about the transcendent, when he speaks about the individual, it has a very different weight and authenticity. When someone like Ken Wilber or any other of this kind speak about all these, you know, terms. So thank you so much for giving me this little place to speak, and I'm so happy, and all your projects may be blessed by Sri Aurobindo himself. Thank you. Jai Ma.